And without further ado, let us delve into the book of Judges, back into the book of Judges. We left it last week at the end of Yiftach's story. And we saw how Yiftach's story created within itself all these parallel patterns. In a sense, it took the theme of the book, the theme that drives the cycle that repeats itself over and over again, of the people abandoning God and then God abandoning them to the not so tender mercies of the people around them. And so the Yiftach story took this theme or this structure and applied it in parallel on several relationships or several interpersonal spaces within the story. First and foremost, God and the people, but also Yiftach and his own brothers and family and community. Later, Yiftach and his daughter and what he owes her. And later, Yiftach and the tribe of Ephraim, whom he massacred on the Jordan River. 42,000 dead, according to the book of Judges. So this was a particularly low point in the book in many ways. And let's pretend that we're, or maybe for some of us we are, but let's pretend we're all first-time readers of the book of Judges. And we reach this low point and we wonder, where is it going to go next? And where it goes is to the story of the man who becomes the last judge, in effect. The stories we will see already in the coming weeks are not stories about judges. They're stories about social, ethical collapse of the Israelite society. But today we're going to talk about the last judge. And in many ways, he is the most enigmatic and anomalous judge of all. Samson is anomalous first and foremost because he, in fact, doesn't function as a judge at all. All the other leaders we met so far in the book, what gives them the ability to enact change and to save the people is that they lead an army. In other words, it's not enough that God sends them. People have to flock to them and work with them. And we saw that it happens in varying ways throughout the book. When Dvorah calls out quite a few tribes, heed her call, even though others do not. When Gideon calls out, people flock so much that he needs to send some of them home. Otherwise, the miraculous nature of the victory wouldn't be clear. When Yiftach fights, people don't flock to him, but rather they come already as an army and ask him to come and lead them. But Shimshon, the last judge, never works with a group. He never works with the people. He works alone. His entire saga, the entire story of his entanglements and victories against the Philistines is all told through the medium or through the channel of his personal engagements and personal acts of revenge against the Philistines over and over again. And it's constantly motivated not by some overtly ideological stance that he takes going out to war against the Philistine and one man against the oppressive nation. No, that's not the story. The story, as it's told in the book of Judges, and I'll say later a few words about what the Midrash does with it, but in the book of Judges, in the simple words of the story, he constantly ends up entangled in these private vendettas against the Philistines because he falls for or desires Philistine women. And every time this desire leads him into an entanglement that eventually leads to violence where he effectively defeats or kills or massacres at times enemies of Israel. But at least on the overt level of the story, he doesn't do it because they're enemies of Israel. He does it because they wrong him, took away his wife, gave her to someone else, cheated him in a guessing game, etc., etc. Chazal, the sages, were very uncomfortable in many ways with the character of Samson. first of all, the fact that he's a judge who works without an army. So who's is he judging, if anything? And secondly, the fact that he keeps chasing all these Philistine women and entangling himself in these personal interest-centered pursuits that lead to good things to Israel, but in a weird way. So Chazal read into the story a lot of mitigating circumstances. They read into his actions master plans for where he is somehow planning all of these entanglements so as to enact revenge on the Philistines. I'm not rejecting. Who am I to reject the work of the sages on the book of Judges? But because our focus in this course is really on the pshat, on what's there in the story, we're not going to go in that direction. And we're going to try and understand without attributing masterminded plans to Samson, why is he the last judge? What is he supposed to represent? Why does a person who seems to be of problematic moral character, seeing as he keeps chasing women and that what motivates him his whole life, why is he the appropriate person to end the story of the judges with? I just want to add one last comment to this bit and say that there is one moment in Samson's life where we see him interacting with a big group of other Israelites. And we might think, oh, great, now he's going to lead them to war. No. The group of Israelites he's interacting with are a group of 3,000 men from the tribe of Judah. He's from the tribe of Dan, and they're from tribe Yehuda. And they come to arrest him and give him over to the Philistines, who threaten to kill them if they don't bring Samson to them. So it's just a little detail, but it really highlights both how unusual Samson's position is within the people and the story, but also how far we came from the beginning of the book, when the people ask God, who should rise up first for us? And God's answer is Judah. The tribe of Yehuda should rise up first. And already then, we saw the tribe of Judah squandering, in a sense, this mission by not leading all the people to war, but rather conducting their own private war and letting the other tribes deal with their own problems. But here, at the life of the last judge, we see Shevet Yehudah reaching, or plummeting, I should say, to its lowest point, where not only are they not leading, but they are appeasing the enemy and not surrendering, there's a different word for it, giving over the hero of the moment, the Jewish hero of the moment, to the hands of their oppressors. Now that I got you all excited about that, looking into Samson, I should say that the bulk of today's class is actually not going to be about about Samson himself and his exploits, even though we will get to him eventually, because there is another anomaly in the Samson story, and today we're going to dedicate quite a lot of time to understanding and unpacking this particular anomaly. And the anomaly is that out of all the many heroes of Jewish history, Samson is one of the only ones, and definitely the only one in the book of Judges, who receives what's called an annunciation scene. In other words, an angel comes and tells his parents that here comes the hero. I am heralding the hero to come. You are pregnant and you have a baby, and the baby's going to be A, B, C, D. This is something extremely rare in Tanakh in general. We see that with Yitzhak. Avraham and Sarah get the message that they're going to have a son, Yitzhak. But even then, the message is more about their happiness to come. The fact that the promises that God made to them about continuity are about to come to pass. They're not told anything about Yitzhak's mission. They're not told what he's going to have to do. But even more tellingly, other great leaders such as Gideon or Dvorah really are, you know, the model leaders of the Judges era in many ways, most righteous and shining examples of the best this era has to offer. They don't receive an annunciation scene. We don't know. We don't have any way to know about them before they're born. And the question we're going to ask today is why? Why does Shimshon need an annunciation scene? What about him requires it? And what can we learn from his scene, from this scene that announces him, that will give us the keys to understanding his particular role and mission in this book? In order to do that, let us look at this scene right now. Here, I'm going to post one last time the source sheet in the chat for anyone who joined now, and I'm going to open it here. And let us read it together. I'm in the top of the source sheet. The Israelites again did what was offensive to the Lord. And the Lord delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. I should say perhaps that the Philistines were people who invaded the land of Israel around the same time that we did. In other words, around the same time that the Israelites came from Egypt, the Philistines came from the Mediterranean. They settled along the coastal plain, mostly the southern coastal plain, the area of Gaza today. And they had various treaties with Egypt at various times. It went on and off. Sometimes they fought against Egypt. Sometimes they fought for Egypt. What we do know about them was that they're very strong warriors. They had strong technology. And they used weapons of iron. So this is the people we're standing against. There was a certain man from Tsoah of the stock of Dan, whose name was Manoah. His wife was barren and had borne no children. This is a very heavy sort of beginning. When we read a story where it starts with a couple and the wife is barren or the people don't have children, we already know that something about their history of parenting is going to be important. And the story delivers. An angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "You are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Now, be careful not to drink wine or other intoxicant or to eat anything unclean, for you are going to conceive and bear a son. Let no razor touch his head, for the boy is to be a Nazarite, a Nazir, to God from the womb on. He shall be the first to deliver Israel from the Philistines." The Hebrew here is Hu Yachel Leoshia et Israel Miad Plishtim, which could be translated as "He will be the first," or "He will begin, he shall start to deliver the Israelites from the Philistines." Now, not only is it weird that Shimshon gets an annunciation scene altogether, it's also a weird scene in several respects. First of all, it's odd that between the man who is named, we know something about him and what the tribe is from, and his wife, who is completely anonymous, the angel talks to the wife. We will see later that Manoah is not so happy with this situation, and there's something odd about it. There's something peculiar and pointed about the fact that the angel doesn't speak to the man of who has a provenance and identity, but rather to the nameless woman. Secondly, no less oddly, the message that the angel brings is odd because the state of the Nazir, my husband is studying Masechet Nazir now, it's a Daf Yomi right now. The state of Nazir is a very carefully constructed legal category that people can only enter willingly. People choose to enter it, and it's supposed to be temporary and very carefully limited. In fact, it's so carefully limited in terms of legal aspects of it, of who can go into it, what does it mean, under what circumstances, in what ways, that it's pretty clear that the sages were kind of trying to discourage people from accepting this odd set of limitations on themselves, not least of which because it's very easy to fail. It's very easy to make mistakes. And if you're drinking grape juice normally, it's not a problem. But if you are a Nazir in grape, it's a big problem. You sinned. And Chazal don't want us to put ourselves in a situation where we're more likely to end up sinning and erring. And yet, here comes the Malach, and willy-nilly tells this woman that her baby not only has no choice in the matter, right? It's not, he's not going to choose to be a Nazirite, but also must be a Nazirite from birth to death. This is odd. This is not normal and usual circumstance. Not only that, but the limits of the Nazirite, the limits on drinking wine and eating grapes, are applying to her as well, as long as she carries him. In other words, it's not only that he's going to be a Nazirite from birth, he's Nazirite from the womb. This is not a normal way of doing things. And even the message itself, the message about what his role is going to be, is, to put it mildly, somewhat ominous. I'm going to repeat it. It's in verse 5 here in the bottom of box 1. For the boy is to be a Nazirite to God from the womb on, as we said, he shall begin, I'm going to translate it a little differently, to deliver Israel from the Philistines. If I was a woman, I would say, wait, 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 what? What do you mean begin delivering Israel from the Philistines? How come he's not going to deliver Israel from the Philistines? What's going to stop him? What's going to be the thing that makes his mission incomplete? So far, every judge we met brought about a decisive victory. Now, it's true that after every judge, a new enemy came and started subjugating us, but it was a new enemy. Whatever enemy we fought against, whatever battle was fought, made us a lasting difference. How come this boy, who's going to be so peculiar and different, is not going to make a lasting difference? As we will see, when the woman tells her husband about it, she changes this statement. Perhaps because it is so disturbing and peculiar, perhaps psychologically she can't process it. We'll get to it in a second. Because before we get to that, I want to point out one more peculiarity, and this is really the peculiarity I want to focus on with you today. Namely, that in this moment, which is a weighty moment for the national history of the Israelites in this era, there's an odd focus on the relationship between one man, whom we don't even meet, the husband of this woman, whose name is Manoah, and one nameless woman. And their relationship is placed in the center here, not only here, we'll read onwards and see how it continues to be in the center, by that, or I should put it differently. The biblical storyteller is drawing what may seem like undue attention to this personal relationship between two insignificant people, insignificant in the sense that they're not going to make a big difference to the story. Their son will, but they're not on the national story. And yet it's the biblical storyteller is drawing attention to them by giving us hints that not all is not well in their relationship. The first hint, as I already mentioned, is that the angel is talking to the woman. This was odd at the time for a woman to be approached by anything, especially anything that looks like a man, without her husband present. As we will see, this is just the beginning, because, forgive me, what happens in the very next moment, in the very next scene, is that the woman tells goes to her husband with this message, and suddenly we see the second hint that all is not well, because she doesn't tell him the truth. There's a gap in the communication. She doesn't actually give him the message as she received it, thus creating a situation when she and her husband are not on the same plane. They're not on an even playing field, so to speak, in terms of understanding what the future is to bring. Let's look at it together. I'm in the second box. The woman went and told her husband, "A man of God came to me. He looked like an angel of God. Very frightening. Nora me'od." And I would translate it, awe-inspiring. "I did not ask him where he was born, nor did he tell me his name. He said to me, 'You are going to conceive and bear a son. Drink no wine or other intoxicant, and eat nothing unclean, for the boy is to be a Nazirite to God from the womb to the day of his death.'" So in here, in this repetition, she is changing some details. First of all, and it's somewhat subtle, she drops the part where the angel told her, you are barren and you are now about to conceive and have a son. She just says, the angel came to me that I'm going to conceive. The sages and the Midrash noticed that and read into it a family tension. They say, perhaps Manoach and his wife were married for a while and didn't have children, and there was some mutual accusations between them about who is at fault, who is the infertile one. And now the angel came and said, here's the truth. You're the infertile one, Mrs. Manoach, whatever your name is, and not your husband. She doesn't pass on this message. She doesn't allow truth to shine on this argument. She subtly makes this part disappear and just gives him what is, I think you will agree, the more pertinent future-oriented information, but there's something repressed here. There's something held back. The second thing she holds back is everything to do with his hair, which, as we will see in the Shimshon story, as we know, is a big deal. He loses his power when Delilah, his second wife, cuts off his hair. So the hair is a big deal. But the woman who was told that the hair cannot be cut off doesn't say so to her husband. And last, as I already hinted to, instead of telling her husband that he will begin to save the Israelites from the Philistines, she says he will be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death. There's something ominous in this subversion or substitution between redemption, the promise of someone who will redeem the people, and the statement until the day of his death. Not only is it somewhat ominous to us who see both of these, but she somehow equates his project with a lifelong project that will end in death. It's also leaving her husband with a very obvious question. Why should this kid be a Nazarite at all? She got the instruction on making him a Nazarite, and the reason he will be special. He will be special because he will carry some sort of national mission. But her husband, as far as he knows, God suddenly, out of the blue, told them that their kid needs to be a Nazarite from the womb, which, as we said, is a totally abnormal and bizarre situation to start with, for nothing. There's no purpose. There's no reason for that. Nothing given. Which I think is fair. It's fair to assume that it leaves him somewhat unsatisfied and somewhat confused, and leaves us, the readers, wondering to ourselves, why is Manoach's wife holding back information? Is it that she's so scatter-minded? Is it that she was overwhelmed by the vision, the awe-inspiring, the Nora vision, as she says, of the angel, and therefore she speaks in a way that is incoherent and drops important information out? Is it that she doesn't want to share information with her husband? Is it that she doesn't trust him, for example, not to spread information about her son's anti-Philistine future? And therefore, she's worried that if her husband talks about it with other people, it will draw the information of the Philistines and they'll try to come and kill him while he's still young, nipping the possible danger to them in the bud. We don't know. Part of what stands out in this scene is that we see this miscommunication happen, but we don't know what moves the woman to speak in this way. Susanna Levin writes in the chat that maybe she felt that the information was private. Very possible. Some of the Midrashim and Parshanim say that exactly that, that she felt that this was a message that God gave her, and she needs to share the pertinent information with her husband. He needs to know not to let the kid bring wine, but she doesn't want to share what she feels is just her information, just something that she's supposed to hold to her own heart. One way or another, we see a couple and we see the gap in knowledge between them. And again, the question is, not only why is a woman misinforming her husband, but the question is, why is it so important for the text to make it clear to us? After all, if the important bit is Samson himself and his exploits, the annunciation scene could have been three sentences. an angel told the woman XYZ, she told her husband about it, and they raised their child accordingly. Instead, we see this careful several verses repetition and are encouraged by it to start comparing and noting the miscommunication, noting the changes between the message she got and the message she's passing on, like a weird broken phone within a family. And the question is, why? Why is it so important? And this question comes forward with us as we see Manoach's response. And if the woman's response is to pass on partial and distorted information, Manoach's response is ridden with doubts. Now, he doesn't say that he's doubting the message. What he says, I'm here still in the box too, in the verse 8, what he says is, I need more information. He says like this, Manoach pleaded with the Lord, oh my Lord, he said, please let the man of God that you sent come to us again and let him instruct us how to act with a child that is to be born. Now, I say it's written with doubt, not so much because of what's in this verse, but because of the whole scene to follow, which we will read together in a second. But already here we see that Manoach doesn't take his wife's word at face value. He doesn't say, great, I'm so proud and excited that God revealed himself to us in some way. No, he wants to be the one who receives revelation. He says to us and let him instruct us. But clearly what he's really saying is, she got the message, I need to get some verification as well. And when the angel comes, we see the same guardedness play out. I'm moving on to the box 3. God heeded Manoach's plea, and the angel of God came to the woman again. This is an ironic turn of events. Manoach clearly wants the angel to come to him as well, and is not happy with the way the revelation only touched his wife. How does God answer that? By sending the angel to her. She was sitting in the field, and her husband Manoach was not with her. The woman ran in haste to tell her husband. She said to him, the man who came to me before has just appeared to me. Manoach promptly followed his wife. He came to the man and asked him, are you the man who spoke to my wife? Now, it should be noted that he doesn't say my wife. He says to the woman, to the wife. Asher dibarta el ha'isha. Abarbanel reads a mild tone of rebuke into the sentence. Abarbanel says that by saying it this way, in a sense, Manoach is hinting to the angel that it's not a done thing for a man, a strange man, to come and talk to a woman, ha'isha, without her husband present. But the angel is ignoring this if the tone of rebuke is intended and says, yes, he answers. Then Manoach said, may your words soon come true. What rules shall be observed for the boy? The angel of the Lord said to Manoach, the woman must abstain from all the things against which I warned her. If Manoach is trying to draw the angel to speak to him, to reveal things to him, the angel keeps referencing back to the revelation that already happened to her. She must not eat anything that comes from the graveyard or drink wine and other intoxicant or eat anything unclean. She must observe all that I commanded her. Note that the angel here doesn't correct any of the miscommunications that the woman initiated. He doesn't tell Manoach about the purpose of the child's mission or goal in life. He doesn't tell him anything about the hair. He doesn't tell him about redeeming Israel from Philistines. It remains strictly within the limits of what the woman communicated to her husband. Thus frustrating at every turn, Manoach's obvious desire to know more, understand more, and be convinced. And even at this moment, Manoach makes a request that is somewhat suspicious, or I'll explain what I mean in a second. Some shows a certain level of suspicion. I'm at verse 15. Manoach said to the angel of the Lord, "Let us detain you and prepare a kid for you." In other words, let us make you a meal. Now, this is a test. An angel doesn't eat food, right? So he's saying, in a sense, are you really a supernatural being? Who are you? What are you exactly? But the angel of the Lord said to Manoach, "If you detain me, I shall not eat your food. And if you present a burnt offering, offer it to the Lord." For Manoach did not know that he was an angel of the Lord. So Manoach said to the angel of the Lord, "What is your name? We should like to honor you when your words come true." The angel said to him, "You must not ask for my name. It is unknowable." This is the third way in which the angel frustrates Manoach's attempt to get something from him. He doesn't give him extra information. He refuses the food, and he refuses to share his name. Manoach is constantly in this position of asking for reassurance, asking for information, trying to control the situation, so to speak, by knowing more. And the angel is not giving into it. Manoach, and now I'm at verse 19, took the kid and the meal offering and offered them up on the rock to the Lord. And a marvelous thing happened. While Manoach and his wife looked on, as the flames leaped up from the altar towards the sky, the angel of the Lord ascended in the flames of the altar while Manoach and his wife looked on, and they flung themselves on their faces to the ground. The angel of the Lord never appeared again to Manoach and his wife. Manoach then realized that it had been an angel of the Lord. We may ask ourselves, what exactly is Manoach's motivation? Why is Manoach so hesitant, so insistent to ask for information and revelation and names and proofs for himself? What's going on in his mind? And the truth is that there's room to interpret it in many ways. His motivation is wide open to interpretation. Some interpretations are more generous. Avraham Kariv, who I'm quoted before, a wonderful Israeli author from the early days of the state, reads Manoach's question very, very generously. He says that Manoach was concerned because his wife told him what they shouldn't do with the child. They shouldn't give him wine. And he said, okay, but maybe there are things that we should do. And since it's such an unusual situation, we should make sure we know. And therefore, he wants the angel to come just because he needs this information. And Avraham Banal and Malbim have similar ideas. You can also read it less generously and say that he is a man who is very cautious, very guarded, very unopen, and it's a closed off, I should say, to situations that don't align with his expectations. And perhaps the real suspicion here at the heart of his behavior is not a suspicion of God. It's not a suspicion that an angel is not revealing something important. It's a suspicion of his wife. It's a lack of trust with his wife. Professors, just a minute, Gunn and Fuel, David Gunn and Donna Fuel, not from within the Beit Midrash, so to speak, read it this way. And they say the following. Manoach is far from content. His wife tells him that she has had a man visit her, and in the same breath, that she's going to have a baby. Dun, dun, dun. Who exactly was this man of God? Was he really a messenger from God? What business had he going directly to Manoach's wife with his communication instead of introducing himself first to the men of the house as only right and proper? And what if the visitor were a messenger of God, was he, Manoach, sure that he knew precisely what being a Nazarite entailed? Should they not have plans for the boy, a pedagogical program? None of the foregoing account of Manoach's interior response is explicit in the text, but it is one likely reading giving what follows. I think that in many respects, we can't really decide one way or another. We can't, you know, pass a judgment. This is what Manoach thought, because the important fact, the thing that stands at the center, is the fact that we don't know. The fact is that an almost entire chapter of Tanakh, of a book of Judges, which is a short book, only 21 chapters. That's a short book, but almost an entire chapter of this book is dedicated to this detailed telling that portrays for us a complicated, tense situation between husband and wife, where mistrust, miscommunication reigns supreme, and the truth, the emotional truth of the relationship isn't clear, isn't presented, isn't present, in a sense. Which brings us back to the question I started of why. Why is the parent relationship, why is there, sorry, relationship between Samson's parents important enough to, I'm sorry, waste, I of course don't mean it, but dedicate an entire chapter to the drama within it. Before I try and answer that, I want to continue a little bit farther with the text and see what happens once Manoach and his wife see the angel rise up. We saw them falling on their faces. We saw Manoach coming to know that it was really an angel of the God. And then one last time, we see them behaving and reacting in ways that highlight the difference between them. Because here is what we see. Just a moment, I'm going to make it a little bigger so everybody can see it. I'll try at any rate. And Manoach said to his wife, this is, by the way, the first time he talks to her. Until now, every time she talked to him, he turned to the angel to speak to him. But now he talks to his wife. We shall surely die, for we have seen a divine being. But his wife said to him, had the Lord meant to take our lives, he would not have accepted a burnt offering, a meal offering from us, nor let us see all these things, and he would not have made such an announcement to us. The woman bore a son, and she named him Samson. The boy grew up, and the Lord blessed them. The spirit of the Lord first moved him in the encampment of Dan between Tzoar and Eshtaol. Manoach is terrified. He thinks that somehow seeing a divine being means that he's going to die. Now, the question of why he thinks he's going to die is an interesting question. Some say that it's simply because this is a sight that human beings are not meant for, so surely it will bring about his death. Surely a human being cannot handle seeing a revelation of an angel. Others, for example, Malbim, whom I brought here only in the Hebrew because I couldn't find an English translation for it, suggest a slightly more nuanced approach. He says something interesting. He says that there was a belief, or it's not so clear if Malbim shares the belief or not, but there's a belief that as long as we're alive, because we are spirits locked in a body made of flesh, we cannot see things that are outside of the realm of flesh, outside of the realm of nature. But when we are on the cusp of death, when our spirit is somewhat loosened from the mortal coil imprisoning it, our eyes open up and we can see things that go beyond the normal reality of life. So what Manoach is saying, according to the Malim, is not we saw an angel and it will cause us to die, but rather the fact we saw the angel means that we're probably on the cusp of death. It means that we can't be fully alive. Either way, it's striking. No matter how you interpret the reason behind his terror, it's striking that Manoach is terrified. He is afraid of death. He, who was so suspicious and guarded, is now in a state of emotional panic. And his wife is very practical. His wife is very common sense. She says, what are you talking about? He just gave us a mission. Why would he give us a mission and then let us die? It doesn't make any sense. What you're saying is not commonsensical. It's nonsensical, I should say. It doesn't add up. And for the first time in the whole story, it seems that he listens to her without reservations, or at least accepts, because we don't see him arguing back. It just, they move on from this moment. So this whole chapter that carefully shows us the disagreements, miscommunications, tensions between these two people ends in a moment when we see their inherent difference. And again, we go back to the question of why. Why is it so important? Now, specifically regarding this, the last moment here, the moment when he's afraid of death and she's, okay, we have a job, let's do it with let's deal with a job now. I think can contribute in a sense to our understanding of the whole book in two significant ways. First, and this is Gunn Fewell's approach, they suggest that this chapter, in a sense, through in a consistent way, by detailing the whole drama between the man and the woman, builds for us, the readers, certain archetypes of masculine religiosity and feminine religiosity. The man who becomes an archetype of all men, and forgive me, all men here, I'm not saying that this actually applies, I'm saying that this is how it's presented here, is very focused on things that are knowable, on familiar, on what he expects. He's suspicious. He doesn't just accept the message willy-nilly. He doesn't fully trust his wife to pass it on to him for good reasons. He wants verification. He wants things to have a name. He wants things to be knowable. And when something happens that incontrovertibly doesn't belong in the realm of things he knows and understands, he panics. He doesn't know how to handle it. The woman becomes a stereotype of feminine religiosity, and she is receptive. She is quick to believe, quick to show faith in the angel. She's not questioning too much. She's not worried. She accepts the mission and goes on with it. Regardless of whether we think this actually accurately describes men and women we know, set that aside for a second. The fact that the chapter builds these almost caricatures of two religious types and then shows that the wife is the wiser of them because she is the one who's more attuned to the truth of the matter throughout. She's the one who's right throughout. The book subverts the expectation of the patriarchal, very man-centric era it was written in. In many ways, it says that the wife, the nameless wife, who in the society she lives in can be described as the woman and not even be given a name. She's not important enough to get a name in that, in the story of that society. She somehow understands God and God's ways and God's messages better than the man. This is an important message, whether or not we agree with it. I'm not trying to, preach some sort of a feminine revival here. My point that I am trying to make is that throughout the book of Judges, we get hints from the biblical storyteller that if we want to heal the era, if we want to transcend the troubles of the era of the judges, we can't just look at reality through the spectacles of our normal, realistic geopolitical expectations. We have to look for God. We have to look for God behind the curtain. We have to see that our losses happen because we lost sight of God and that our victories are because God is giving us power. Only by recognizing the hidden reality underneath the geopolitical world as we know it, can we restore the link of memory, restore the covenant with God, and hopefully elevate ourselves out of the cycle of the era of the judges? So by portraying to us a woman who is somehow more attuned, more astute, more faithful than her husband, and thus subverting expectation about religiosity and authority that a reader in that era would come into the story with, the book is once again telling us, stop looking at reality the way you do. Stop looking at the normal way things are. Stop, thinking in terms of whatever culture you're in, moment you're in. Things are not as they seem, and you need to constantly look for the way they're not as they seem if you ever want to break the pattern and get out. And this, in a sense, leads us to why I think Manoah and his wife are so central to the message about Shimshon, to the story of Shimshon. Because Shimshon works alone, chases women, dies in a way that is somewhat anonymous, but throughout his whole life, He exemplifies and encapsulates to us what happens when the basic covenant between man and woman doesn't hold. His first marriage ends when his wife betrays his secrets to her Philistine friends under threats and pressure, under threats. They threaten to kill her, so she gives over a secret to them. His second wife betrays his secrets in a much more devastating way. She gives the Philistines the power to imprison him, not under threat, but under the lure of bribes, under the lure of wealth. So this man who is constantly desiring, who's constantly chasing something outside himself, cannot build a covenanted, true, trusting relationship with a woman in his life. And this is already foreshadowed for us in the much more conventional yet deeply flawed relationship between Manoach and his wife, between the parents who are about to bring him into the world. It's almost like the biblical storyteller is turning on a flashlight and says, already here, relationships between men and women are going to be important. Pay attention. This is what you should focus on. This is the key to what happens in Samson's life. The obvious question is, why is that the key? Why is Shimshon's regrettable private tragedy when it comes to married life, to the covenanted state of married life, important to us, the readers? In other words, it's very nice to say that Manoach and his wife are there to foreshadow his own failures in marriage, but why are his failures of marriage so important? And I think they're important because they're not just a personal story. They are a mashal, a metaphor for the deepest layer of failure that underlies all the other failures of the era of the judges. The failure of the covenant between us and God. Because what is the root of all evil? What is the root of all evil in judges? The root of all evil in judges is that the people forget God, forget what God did for them when he took them out of Egypt and through the desert and brought them to the land of Israel and helped them win, the wars with Joshua in the land of Israel. And because they forget, they stray to other idols. Straying is a particularly loaded word in Shimshon context because Shimshon is someone who goes after his eyes. He sees a beautiful woman, he desires her. The people see idols, they desire them. Sometimes what lures, and in that regard, they're like Shimshon, but in some ways they're also like the wives in the Shimshon story. Sometimes what leads them away from God is fear. They're afraid of the people around them, so they want to be like the people around them and worship the same gods, behave in the same way. You could say a preventative assimilation to prevent anti-Semitism from starting. At other times, they are lured away by the opulence, success, beauty, riches of the people around them. This is a more insidious temptation in a sense. They're not scared. They desire. Like Lila, who was lured by the promise of wealth given to her by the Philistines to betray the covenant. So it is very fitting that the judge, who in many ways is the ending, the nekuda, the dot, like the dot at the end of a sentence.
The point.
Yeah. Thank you.
Completion.
The judge who is the end point of the whole cycle of judges. The judge whose life encapsulates just how far we've gone when we see him being enslaved by the Philistines at one point, when we see him being given over to the Philistines by his own brothers at another point. The judge who really brings it all together for us. It's very appropriate that his personal life sheds a light or puts the light of our attention, draws our attention to the basic sin that brought us all the way there, to the failure in our trust in God, in our communication with God, in all the things that make a covenanted relationship work with God. Now, just a second. that in and of itself is a very depressing ending and worthy of a depressing book, let's be honest, right? And I'm not forgetting there's a few more chapters and several stories, just they're different. They present a different look into the whole era, and we'll get to them in the weeks to come. But it was a depressing process so far, a depressing ride, and this is its depressing endpoint. So what's there to say? Except that as we already saw throughout the book, in the heart of the tragedies of the judges, in the heart of the difficulties of this era, hide little points of light, little hints about the right path to redemption. And Shimshon's story is no exception. Because in between his misalliances and misadventures, we see a fascinating phenomena that repeats itself twice in his life. And in order to show this phenomena, I should say something about the structure of Shimshon's stories. Shimshon's stories are organized into 6 narrative units, and each 3 of those form a set. They all start, each of those narrative, or I should say 2 halves of the story, right? I should say it like that. There's 2 parts in the Shimshon story. Each of these parts start when he desires a Philistine woman. Each of these parts ends when he is at war with them and betrayed by the woman, and in some way loses his power. And in both of those cases, at the moment of loss of power, and this comes at the kind of climax of each of those 2 halves, he turns to God. He turns to God and he prays. The first time happens after he won a great victory against the Philistines. He killed thousands of them, but he is so thirsty that he feels he's dying. And he turns to God and prays a very short prayer, and God immediately makes a spring come out of the earth for him. The second time is more dramatic. It is after he was betrayed by Delilah. His hair was shorn. He was blinded. His eyes were taken out by the Philistines, and he was brought to their grand party in the temple of their god Dagon, so people can laugh at him and feel good about themselves. And at that moment, famously, he puts his hands to the columns that hold the building together, and he prays. Let us see this prayer together. A moment. I'm at the very, very last box of the source sheet. Once again, his prayer itself is very short. He says, "O Lord God, please remember me and give me strength just this once, O God, to take revenge of the Philistines, if only for one of my 2 eyes." It's kind of a weird prayer, right? We would expect that maybe at this point he would have a more grand prayer, but no, he's still focused on his own concerns and his own revenge. He's still himself. And yet the prayer is answered immediately. He embraced the 2 middle pillars that the temple rested upon, one with his right arm and one with his left, and leaned against them. Samson cried, "Let me die with the Philistines." And he pulled with all his might. The temple came crushing down on the lords and on all the people on it. Those who were slain by him as he died outnumbered those who had been slain by him when he lived. And thus, both phrasings of his mission, the phrasing that he will start redeeming his people from the Philistines and their prediction that he will do so until his dying day, come together as one. But why is it significant? Why is the fact that in both of these kind of arcs of his life, the ending is a prayer that's answered, a prayer of need, not a prayer of, "Oh God, help the people." No, it's a prayer of, "I'm thirsty," or, "I want revenge," and God immediately answers them. I think that there, in that little fact, in that little oddity, lies the hopeful direction, or the hopeful hint that the Shimshon story, the last Shofet story in the book of Judges, gives us. Because in a sense, what it tells us is this. As long as Shimshon is busy with a lot of relationships, he's not living the most upright life. He's not living his best life. he is chasing women. He is, Rabbi Kalman, are you here? Just the recording seems to have stopped.
No, it's still recording. The little red
still
light.
Recording.
Sorry. So it's a glitch in my computer. In this moment that he's suffering for real, either from thirst or from the humiliation as he stands there being mocked in the temple, he leaves all of that behind. He's not chasing women, arguing with Philistines, talking to his parents. He's not doing any of that. He is in a one-on-one tête-à-tête with God. He turns to God and communicates his need to God. And when he does that, God answers. Perhaps signaling to us, both the Israelites of that era and to us learning from this book today, that when we turn to God honestly, when we are ready to restore the line of communication, the intimate communication with God, and let go of all those idolatrous relationships, adulterous and idolatrous relationships with other nations and other gods, let go of all the things that are casting a shadow on our covenant. When we are ready to turn to him, regardless of the history between us, regardless of the sins between us, he will listen. In other words, to put it somewhat formulaically, Shimshon's story shows us on the personal level, both in his life and less so, but still significantly in the life of his parents, what happens when the covenanted trust between man and woman collapses. But it also shows us that when it comes to the covenant between us and God as a people, restoration, redemption of the same covenant is in fact possible, is in fact something that we can grasp for and restore. And on that happier and more optimistic note, I have to round up today's class. Unfortunately, I do not have time to look at the chat. I hope that as always, feel free to ask Torah in Motion for my email and message me if it's particularly important to you that I either respond to you directly or mention it in the coming classes if you think it's important for everybody. On that note, I will wish to us that our covenant with God will in fact sustain us as we go through a difficult time now and inspire us to rise and lead a upright and God-blessed life. And on that note, I'm wishing all of you
Amen. Thank you.
Shavuot Tov. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next week, I assume no class because of Purim?
No class. So I guess I should say Purim Sameach, right? We see the upturning of reality, and we will reconvene after Purim.
Thank you. Chag Sameach.